This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Philadelphia has thousands of vacant and abandoned properties scattered across the city. They're generally seen as eyesores that can lower property values and cause neighborhood problems. The people behind Hidden City Philadelphia have been searching for architectural and historical buildings that have fallen into disrepair. They've uncovered 9 sites across the city and paired them with artists for their second Hidden City Festival, which runs through the end of June. They want to change the way Philadelphians look at their city and inspire the spirit of preservation. Joining us are 3 members of Hidden City's creative team. They've joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Let me introduce each of them to you. Thaddeus Squire is the founder of Hidden City Philadelphia, publisher of the Hidden City Daily. And Thaddeus, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Lee Tussman, creative director of Hidden City Philadelphia, also curator of the festival. And Lee, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much.
And rounding things out, Peter Woodall, Hidden City's outreach director, co-founder, co-editor of the Hidden City Daily. I should say several years ago was a fill-in producer on Radio Times. And Peter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Thaddeus, let me begin with you because you seem to be the part of the mastermind of this festival. The last festival was, what, 4 years ago in 2009?
It was in 2009, around about the same time.
And what was the thinking in the last 4 years for this second festival?
Well, the thinking was to figure out how we could have the organization move on and how the festival could be repeated. We didn't really intend it to repeat. It could have been a one-off thing,
right.
But the response was so overwhelming, both publicly and otherwise, to the experience. We wanted to really sort of invent a future for both the festival and its efforts to invent a new future for the city.
And when we talk about a festival, how would you describe it, Lee?
This is a festival where we work with artists to design socially based projects that involve participation to imagine new futures that are either very practical or very fantastical inside spaces that are underknown to the public.
And underknown meaning that we probably a lot of these, and I've looked at your catalog, you pass them every day, you probably don't pay a lot of attention, or if you do, thinking, oh gosh, what happened to this building?
They're historic spaces, but they're not ones that we necessarily always think about. Very different from some of the colonial history in Philadelphia. These could be industrial spaces and other places that are kind of off of the typical, you know, historic map.
And Peter, I'm curious about what the process was. I mean, these are 9 sites. The city is filled with thousands of, I guess, potential sites. Why these 9?
Well, my job was to find these spaces. I was already taking pictures of them, exploring particularly North Philadelphia before coming to Hidden City. And really we were looking for spaces that most of which weren't in use, but they had to have a caretaker of some sort. So one that actually cared about it in some way. You know, there's a lot of vacant buildings where, you know, someone owns it and doesn't care about it.
Yes.
And we wanted to see all the, you know, more or less most of the neighborhoods represented, really get out there into the city and show folks that there's, I mean, Philadelphia's an enormous town.
Yeah, and there's a
just this is Thaddeus.
Just to be clear about the expanse, I mean, Lee said underknown.
Yes.
We're really not just looking at the derelict or sort of closed and inaccessible sites, but there's some that are very well cared for, but just sort of literally underknown, like the Athenaeum in this year's festival, which is very well cared for, but is one of the hidden sort of gems of the city. In the first festival, we had Mother Bethel AME Church on 6th Street, which is a magnificent building, also very well cared for, but just underknown by local, regional, and sort of tourist folks. So it's about that full spectrum, not just the inaccessible and sort of rotting, although that's what a lot of people
sure.
know us for,
sure.
But also sites that really just need some greater bandwidth.
Well, I wonder, Lee, if you could talk about the Fort Mifflin and Mud Island. I mean, this is the, I guess, the first one in this catalog.
Sure. Yeah, this is actually, I mean, this site has a long history. You know, it was built to defend against the British, and actually the British overtook the fort for a period of time. In the late 1700s, 1777. And this is a site where we're actually working with 2 artists that are based out of Philadelphia, Zach Weber and Ben Nieditz, who are both sculptors but also urban anthropologists and had studied a history of improvised and temporary settlement. And they were attracted to this area near the airport that's also very, very old, and there's also no physical remnants of these informal settlements, so they decided to build their own as a way to evoke that history as well.
You want to talk a bit more about that, Peter, just because it's such a curious, as you said, near the airport, kind of a curious part of this region.
It really is, and, you know, just to go back, I found that site because, you know, the artists had really wanted this sort of post-industrial landscape to be where their project was sited, and they had an initial site that was near Bartram's Gardens. But we couldn't work out an arrangement with the folks who owned the property. So, you know, it was getting kind of late in the day. The festival was coming up. So I actually went on Google Satellite, and I just started going down the river and looking for patches of green that were near something industrial, and stopped at Fort Mifflin, gave him a call. Director answered the phone on the first ring, and she said...
That's a good sign.
She said, oh, we own that property. And I didn't know, you know, who had owned it. It could have been one of the oil companies. And everything worked out great. Wow. So
from a Google's perspective, what did you see?
I saw... Well, actually, what I saw was the original outline of the island. The island has been filled in over the last 250 years. There was once a back channel that separated from the city. Wow. And it was kind of sword-shaped. It had kind of a point to it. And that green patch was the point. And so, you know, the satellite was able to capture some of that original geography, even though so much has been changed around there.
I'm curious about this idea of putting artists in some of these sites. I mean, what your thinking is, Thaddeus?
Well, the original thinking, actually, going back to 2009, and the 2009 festival started in partnership with the Preservation Alliance for Greater Philadelphia, and it took 4 years to prep and plan for that. And originally, we were trying to solve an art problem. How could we bring more audiences to very experimental art? And as the 2009 festival evolved and as we moved into thinking about the 2013 festival, it really became about solving a problem and bringing more exposure to place and the people around it. So it sort of reversed. It was not about necessarily getting more audiences for art, although that's happening.
Right.
It's sort of a reciprocal thing. So we place becomes a portal for people to experience contemporary work by contemporary artists. But also the artists provide a portal for people to kind of see the places anew. So it's that kind of exchange between those two forces that really the whole festival is about. And ultimately, it's about not only having people understand more about the story and the history of the city that they may not know. There are a myriad of really fantastic stories and places out there. But also we want to get people curious and interested and engaged enough to not just come back several times for the festival, which we'd like, but beyond the festival to get engaged locally in those communities and with those places to imagine new futures for them. And we had some examples from the first festival that were wonderful accidents. I can't say that we intended them to happen, but they were great outcomes of that energy. And so places that were reused or saved resulted from that.
And the idea that something in 2009 that was used is still being used or perhaps has kind of been reinvented by the people that are using it?
Yes. There are three notable cases for that. And again, we weren't the only agents, but it was the starting point. Founders Hall at Girard College, which is up near Eastern State. The fourth floor or third floor of that building, which dates from the mid-19th century, hadn't been used since 1906 when we opened it up. So
wow.
It was the first time in a very long time. And initially, the college was resistant, owing to just concerns over liability and things like that, and then became very enamored of the idea of opening up as art space. And it's been used since the 2009 festival by other festivals like Live Arts and has been used as a site for art making. A building at the Distant Sawworks in North Philadelphia, this is a contrasting example, was sort of slated to be demolished. The owners of the Sawworks, which still operate the business there, were so taken by the public response to the site. It was the highest visited site in the 2009 festival, also the most geographically remote, which is an interesting fact from Center City. They ended up leasing it to one of their clients, and so now it's being used for industrial use. So, you know, one sort of nonprofit, one sort of for-profit example, but a lot of that came from the energy generated by the first festival.
Lee, is there a building or even perhaps part of this festival that you feel a certain affinity for?
Wow, this is a hard one because I curated the whole thing.
It's like asking you about your favorite
children.
And I
don't want to say that. But there are some that we can already see the process that Thaddeus was just talking about in motion. An example of that, for example, is Shivte Yisharon, which is the Row House Synagogue in South Philadelphia at 4th and McKean. That site had a fairly small congregation, at least that was active, people mostly in their 80s and 90s, though younger people as well. And they wanted to figure out a way to have a larger group of people and open it up to the community in larger ways, particularly because the neighborhood around it isn't, obviously it's not an intensive Jewish community the same way it used to be in the early waves of immigration, particularly in the 10s, 20s, and 30s. And so for that site, what we found is we've helped kind of kickstart something going on there where past members as well as current members and their families have really stepped up to become participants, caretakers. You're also seeing services start again. They had been happening but not regularly, and they're actually happening regularly again. There's all kinds of work that's been done on the site, both by us as well as members of the congregation and the board of the synagogue. And so we've only just begun the festival over the weekend, and it's already a success story.
Oh, that's interesting. And Peter, this is a storefront.
That's right.
In deep South Philly, right?
That's right. We don't think of storefront synagogues. They're something that were actually incredibly common, you know, around 1900, 1910, 1920. We actually think there might be about 140 of them at one time.
Really?
South of South Street, between Broad and the river. And they were part of that second wave of Jewish immigration. The first wave was mostly German, better educated, more affluent. The second wave came from Eastern Europe and Russia. It was much poorer, and they actually got off at a pier at Washington Avenue. So they started down south, and they stayed there, and their circumstances were very modest, and so they worshipped where they could. And in this case with Shivte, it was a storefront that they converted into a shul, which is Orthodox shul that was sort of what you can also call a synagogue.
So, and we're almost up at a break here, so is it finding the building and then discovering the history, or is it finding the history and then finding the building, or discovering the history and finding the building?
It can be both. Sometimes, you know, there's just wonderful things that pop up that you didn't know were there. And honestly, I had no idea the synagogue was there until I think someone actually tipped us off about it.
Wow.
We actually just got an email from the ether. And that's
so
how
Google
we found out.
And the ether.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Hidden City Philadelphia. And if you want to check out their website, festival.hiddencityphila.org, you can find out about the 9 sites that are part of this festival that runs through the end of June, talking with Peter Woodall, Thaddeus Squire, and Lee Tussman. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chestnut Hill College School of Graduate Studies offers a variety of degree programs designed to take your education and career to the next level. That includes both doctoral and master's degree programs. Our dedication to learning can transform knowledge, skill, and experience into a meaningful and impactful career. Chestnut Hill College is holding an information session on Thursday, June 6th. Details and more online at chc.edu/visit. Chestnut Hill College is a proud supporter of WHYY.
You decide the winners at WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs, June 20th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Food fanatics will love this 2-hour tasting, featuring an array of mouth-watering munchies served up by local restaurants and businesses, all competing to be named 2013's Best of the Chefs, with summer beer garden, specialty cocktails, and live music. WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs. Tickets at whyy.org/events.
Reporting a rape in Pakistan can lead to more punishment for the victim than for the accused.
She's an outcast. She will never get married. She's destined to be killed by someone from her own family because she's impure now.
But one young woman is speaking up anyway, all the way to the high court. We'll talk with the filmmakers of Outlawed in Pakistan. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Hidden City, Philadelphia has identified 9 sites across the city, buildings that have fallen into some degree of disrepair but have an interesting architectural and historic significance. Their festival runs through the end of June, and we're talking with some of the Hidden City's creative team, Thaddeus Squire, the founder of the group, Lee Tussman, the creative director, and Peter Woodall, Hidden City's outreach director. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Thaddeus, let me go back to you. What do you want the public to experience from this? And by that, I mean, is it a matter of sort of looking differently at the buildings that we might pass every day and seeing something else that we might not have noticed before?
Yes, it's all of that. At a very basic level, we want people to kind of catch the curiosity bug. At the core of all of this, it's about sort of being more curious about the city and you know, having the will and desire to go out and explore both sort of geographically neighborhoods that you haven't been to and also topically histories and stories that you might not know. And ultimately, we want people to catch the bug so bad that they get involved and really sort of go beyond just reading the Daily, which is a wonderful platform for these stories to come out, but to kind of get physically involved and spiritually, morally involved in these neighborhoods and places that they're discovering.
And the idea is to preserve or save these buildings, or to think of other buildings that could use some love and care. And
indeed, and to think about how they can have value to society and the public alone. Hidden City is really not a purist preservation organization. It's not about just sort of preserving it the way it is, but it's looking at a building or a place and saying, what can we make of this? How can this serve either this community or a group of people better? So it's not just about preservation. It goes beyond that to ask a much more fundamental question about what's the value of this stuff to us and how can that the story behind it and its history inform what that future value might be. To Philadelphia and beyond.
Go ahead, Lee.
Well, and I just want to add to that, I think it's not necessarily inherently obvious why we're working with artists to imagine new futures for these spaces. And to be clear, outside of the festival, we also cover other kinds of ways that people reuse spaces too. That's not our only interest. But I think what's interesting about that is artists come up with ideas in a way that an architect or a developer or even the city and city government might not. And these are sometimes, admittedly, very strange ideas or very non-traditional. But they're not always, and even when they are, they still get something going. People come out of the woodwork. They imagine a new use, even if temporary. It's just a way to get started. And I think that's actually something that's something that's very difficult, and you need to overcome that initial inertia, right? And so there might not be $4 million or $5 million to restore a building in some way that's like, totally restoring it back to the original, nor might there be a need for that anymore. But there might be something very tactical, and an artist helps come up with a framework to get started with doing something.
And that's...
Go ahead, Thaddeus, and then Peter, I'd like to... Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, I think this issue, we call them in the office impossible buildings. There are these buildings out there that are sort of perpetual conundrums. There's Divine Lorraine on North Broad that's been subject of a lot of press. Germantown Town Hall in the festival is kind of a notorious building that people just don't know what to do with. They're big, they're expensive. And some of the issue is just getting people, as Lee said, over that barrier to thinking about the possible, not thinking about the impossible. And that in a very basic way, in an unadulterated way, is what artists often do. So we start with that as that kind of initial energy.
Peter, let me go back to another one of these buildings. This is Hawthorne Hall. The outside structure, this is your photograph, I'm assuming.
It is.
It's mythic. It's big, it's beautiful, it's falling apart. Talk about Hawthorne Hall.
Well, it was built all at once as a block, and there was retail on the first floor and apartments above, and there was a funny little theater that was stuck in there, and that's why it's called Hawthorne Hall. There's a hall inside. But even though they built it all at once, they actually deeded it separately, so there's 17 separate deeds, which is one of the reasons why it's been so hard to fix it up all at once. Different little parts of it have been fixed up over the years, but the theater and a number of other spaces in it are still vacant. And, you know, I used to actually, my first apartment was right next door to it.
Oh, you're kidding.
I lived on Hamilton Street. Oh, we used to actually.
This is on Lancaster Avenue.
Yeah, yes. And there's actually a bar in that block, and we used to go to it and listen to jazz. And so, and I never knew there was a theater upstairs. I think very few people did. And then I actually ran into someone from the People's Emergency Center, which is sort of the neighborhood CDC up there in Palatine, and they mentioned the space, and I said, I should take a look at that. And they said, well, we don't really know exactly what we're going to do with it, but we own it, and we think it's amazing, and, you know, we've been kind of showing it around just a little bit here and there, but, you know, maybe we're ready for a lot more people to see it.
And it does look like, looking at some of your photographs here, it looks like, I mean, time has stopped, right?
Absolutely. That's one of the most amazing things that you see again and again when you explore vacant spaces is how often people just like turned off the lights, locked the doors, and left everything inside. That's certainly true at Germantown Town Hall, where the last city office, you know, the filing cabinets are still there. The calendar says 1996.
Wow.
You know, there's, you know, typewriters.
with pages in them in mid-type. That's right.
Oh, is that right? So,
yes.
I mean, just like out of the Twilight Zone.
It is. I mean, Distin, when we opened up the Distin factory, their infirmary had been closed like that, and the physician's log was still open on the desk with a layer of dust on it, and the last entry was sometime in the 1950s. And there were dishes in the sink, the beds were made, cabinets with medicine. Everything had just been left. It's kind of magical when you open up those kinds of spaces.
Indeed. But let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're talking about Hidden City Philadelphia, their festival that just began, and it runs through the month of June. They have identified 9 sites across the city that you can go visit, and there are art installations or performances that are happening in these sites as well. And again, our guests are Peter Woodall, Lee Tussman, and Thaddeus Squire. Let me get Jim from Conshohocken to join us. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a sculptor, and for years I've had this idea about the neoclassical kind of buildings in Philadelphia that have these niches. And I think it's fascinating that they never put any sculpture in these niches when they built them. And yet that's what the niches are designed for. They're designed to have pieces of sculpture in them. And I thought it would be a wonderful kind of thing if sculptures, contemporary sculptures, could be put in these niches in either a temporary way or a permanent way. An example of one of these buildings is the library building on Logan Circle that has these, you know, perfect, you know, neoclassical niches in them. And so I just thought that, and I know there's others throughout the city, and it just seemed like, you know, architects used to do the style of neoclassicism, but they never completed them. So it's just an idea, and I wonder, you know.
That's a good one, Jim. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Lee, can I toss that first to you?
Sure, yeah. That is a wonderful idea. There needs to be more of that, and I think, you know, there's lots of examples like that we could find across the city. And, you know, the hardest part, again, is getting started. And I think there's, you know, we're not the only ones that need to do it. There should be lots of people that are interested in doing, you know, public art and all kinds of participatory and alternative sculpture and other ways.
But it is interesting to think about a space and what would work there.
I mean, yes.
Would it be a sculpture? Would it be a performance? Would it be something else?
It should probably be all of those.
And all of the above.
Yeah. There's a great story. One of the most famous empty or unfinished exterior spaces are I forget the architectural term, but the pentamids at the top of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the triangular spaces at the end of the bays.
Oh, sure.
That it sort of look odd because they're brick. They look a little unfinished. Well, they were unfinished. They were actually supposed to be home to these large pieces. I think it was going to be terracotta. And over the years, the museum has had several projects to kind of fill those in. One was actually video projections that was proposed, and it wasn't realized. So it's not always material. Artists can come up with very interesting solutions to some of those problems.
Indeed. Let me get to Marianne from Swarthmore to join us. And Marianne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
My father worked at a distant sawmill for many, many years, I went on the tour last time. And I just want to thank you so much for giving me such a profound connection with him, because it wasn't the type of place you would take a child for, daughter's day at work type of thing, in the 1950s
right?
I was growing up. But I must say, you did an amazing job, the artists did with the mapping and the sense of the industrial activity that took place there. And I just want to thank you so much, and I'm hoping to get to the Frankfurt Historical Society this time.
Great.
Thank you, Marianne. Great. Yeah, thanks. Anyone want to add to what she just said?
Sure.
Peter, go ahead.
The industrial history of Philadelphia is something that's really close to my heart and to Hidden City in general. It's really what made Philadelphia the city we see today. The colonial history is one thing. It's obviously incredibly important, but industry made Philadelphia. We were the workshop of the world. And so for this festival, I really wanted to find an industrial space, and we went through a number of different options and ended up with two. We ended up with Globe Dye Works up in Frankfurt, and also John Grass Wood Turning, which is in Old City. And that's just mind-boggling, that the John Grass shop, because Old City is actually an older stage of industrial development. It's actually pre-Civil War.
Right.
And John Grass dates from, I believe, what does it say,
1863.
Yeah, 63. And so someone had... Wood turning is turning wood on a lathe to make something rounded, so flagpoles, balustrades, things like that. And it had stayed in the same family for five generations, more or less. And they hadn't changed a thing. There were still these leather-belted pulleys that were driven by a central engine in the basement. Mm-hmm. And so it really, truly was a time capsule, but it was a functional one. They were doing a lot of... specific details for restoring historic buildings at the end of their run, which was only 10 years ago they closed.
Well, and Thaddeus, picking up on something you said before, it sounds like, again, they closed, and we see there's a photograph here, what looks like a 19th century wood turning company.
Yeah, it's
in fact, it is.
It
right?
is. It's magical. I mean, they left it, now it was operating up until a couple of decades ago, but they it really is unchanged since its turn-of-the-century kind of appearance, and they just left everything. In fact, there are parts of the building where the piles of wood are actually holding the building up, some of the floor joists. Because it's
L&I, right?
No. Well, there's a lot of preservation work to be done on it, and that's something that we're looking forward to participate in. But going back to Mary's comment about connecting back to family history, that was a huge part of the Distant Project that was totally unexpected. The artists discovered this whole community of people who were still very generationally close to that factory. And in fact, we got that and continue to get that, as Lee's saying, with Shivte. That's one of the magical things, is people are reconnecting to a lot of history and heritage and family and relationships related to these places. 2009 festival, we opened up the Royal Theater, the first time it had been open in 40 years. It's a theater on South Street, one of the first African-American cinemas in Philadelphia, also a jazz venue in the early 20th century. It had become a movie theater until the early 70s, and people came to the performance that was there with ticket stubs from the last film they had seen before it closed.
Oh, what were the dates on
and
the stubs?
I believe it closed in 1972. So they had kept them, and... there was a very, and again, unexpected sort of emotional kind of atmosphere the first night we opened the theater, because so many people were there who had remembered it operating and were sort of back in connection to it. So it's just an interesting thing.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have a caller who wants to talk about the synagogue. Gary from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. And Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I've been going there since 1980. I moved into the neighborhood, and... it was an Orthodox shul. It still is semi-Orthodox, but The man who used to take care of it, Alden, who owned the property, used to, when a shul would close down in South Philly, they had their boards of memory, names of people who passed away that they used to have in their shuls. They would take those boards over to the shul that was in existence along with their Torahs.
Wow.
And then those lights would be lit for those people when a year's anniversary of their death would come up. So it got so that we had too many Torahs. So my wife, may she rest in peace, she decided to paint the shul inside. And when we were painting the shul, we found a trap door. Inside the trap door were about 14 Torahs wrapped in sheets.
Wow.
And then Alvin started to give them away. A couple, I think he gave one to Greaterford Prison. He gave one to the shul at 5th and Pine. I think he gave one to 5th and Lombard. But he didn't need them all, and it was very charitable of him to give them away. They're very expensive. Of course, they had to be koshered again. But
well, that's fascinating, Gary. No, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm thinking it sounds like a Mel Brooks play, Too Many Torahs, doesn't it? Anything you want to add to that, Lee?
Yeah, I would say another site that we're finding, you know, people coming out of the woodwork and telling about their own experience with a site that's been closed for a while is Kelly Natatorium at Fairmount Park, that's underneath the waterworks. That's a very old site, and it's had a lot of different, you know, it's served a lot of different purposes over the years, and it's gone from being a site that was very practical, you know, in terms of generating energy to then kind of, you know, when it no longer had that purpose or no longer that need, they turned it into an aquarium. Then it was a pool.
A swimming pool, right?
What's that?
A swimming pool.
That's right. That's where we come up with the name Natatorium, which I think some people are wondering, what does that mean? That's what that is.
Fancy word.
Yes.
Fancy word. Peter, you want to add to that?
We've actually apparently, since they repurposed this room for the swimming pool, there was these columns that went right down the center of the swimming pool that they couldn't move. They were holding up the ceiling. So those columns stayed when they were doing the pool. We actually have had 4 people come and tell us about chipping their teeth on those columns.
As they were doing their laps
or
swimming?
Absolutely.
Wow. So how long ago were people actually swimming in this pool?
That pool was closed after Hurricane Agnes. The hurricane actually flooded the pool area, wow, and the city just said, okay, we're done with this. The pool itself was actually only open for a little more than a decade.
Wow. Wow.
When Pete says Hurricane Agnes, that predates, you know, his being born. So that was in the 1970s. That's the early 70s.
Yeah, pardon me. Yeah, yeah. It was actually, I think it was the year I was born, 72.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, wow. Or 73.
On that site, the artists have designed a project that they call the Bebatorium. And it's actually, you know, they've used these basically 3 lanes of this pool, and they've designed a tea bar, a water bar, where visitors can learn about essentially the future of water and different ways that water is affected today in terms of hydrofracturing and, you know, fracking, pollution, and salinity. And so in addition to having a leisurely experience enjoying tea, interacting with the artists, seeing an amazing space, you're also learning about some serious issues and are able to start a dialogue about these issues affecting water today.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about Hidden City, Philadelphia. And again, the festival running through the month of June. You can check it out at festival.hiddencityphila.org. You can also give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. The voice you just heard is Lee Tussman, the creative director of Hidden City. Also with us, Thaddeus Squire, the founder of the group, and Peter Woodall, Hidden City's outreach director. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer, based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
Who dares enter the funhouse of fear? Stephen King. His new novel, Joyland, is set in an amusement park. As a teaser for the book says, beyond the lights, there is only darkness.
Read the line again.
You like it that much? You want to hear it again?
Can I write or what? God. Just kidding.
Stephen King on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Should parents be liable if their unvaccinated children cause other kids to get sick? Also, the move to rebuild the largest train station in North America, New York's Penn Station. There's one problem. Madison Square Garden is on top of it and would have to go. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Philadelphia is, of course, known for its many historic buildings, Independence Hall, Christ Church, the Masonic Temple. There are other structures in the city, though, that have fallen on hard times that also have architectural and historical significance. Hidden City Philadelphia has identified 9 of those sites for its current festival. As I said, it runs through the end of June. We have put a slideshow on our website. If you go to whyy.org/radiotimes, you can see what some of these sites look like. You can also give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 and talk with our guests, Thaddeus Squire, the founder of Hidden City Philadelphia, Lee Tussman, the creative director, and Peter Woodall, Hidden City's outreach director, and just a couple of open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Thaddeus, I almost hate to ask this question, but do you have to think about things like liability? I mean, here you have kind of dilapidated buildings. You're opening to the public. Did you have to consult with your legal team to see how to do this?
Yes. Everybody always asks the liability question.
I know. I'm embarrassed, but
No. It's a good question. Surprisingly, the insurance for the festival is fairly conventional. We insure all the sites. We also work with the city regulators and agencies for sites that aren't normally open to the public. There's a process called the temporary certificate of occupancy. A certificate of occupancy is an approval from the city that all buildings have to have the public safely in them. And so for at least one of the buildings, we've had to do that, Germantown Town Hall, this time around. First time we had to do several buildings mm-hmm. with a TCO. And provided we have that and the insurance, it's fine. But the biggest, we don't have people sign waivers, as some people might expect. Largely because the biggest assurance that nothing's going to happen is tight operational control and good oversight. And so we have over 150 volunteers. We have paid site managers who are responsible for the local operations on the site. So we've put a lot of care and attention to make sure that everybody behaves properly and doesn't do anything that's foolish. People get really stupid in old buildings.
Yes, I can imagine. So
we try to resist that. But that's really the best measure. We've had no incidents.
Good. Peter, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, it's just I've learned a lot about permits.
That's true.
Congratulations.
Yeah. We've actually reached out to the theater community, our production manager, Brian Clark. He has all these guys who are used to coming in and just building things really quickly. So if we need a railing, you know, we get a railing. If we need, you know, a hole in the floor patched, they do that. And so they're really great about that.
Lee, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, it's funny, Marty and Sadie said we get asked all the time about liability and permits and things like that. You know what's actually harder? This is going to... It might blow people's minds, and I don't know, but it's actually a lot harder to get permission of the owner of the building. You'd think that many times the owner of a building would want people to see this space and get connected to it, you know, again, because potentially could help them in the long run, you know, open up a space, find new users, or even connect to someone that might want to lease or rent the space. But people are embarrassed is one thing we found. You know, when the things that attract, you know, at least the Hidden City team and our festival participants and visitors is that these spaces no one's gone in them before. There's some dust, there's sawdust, mm-hmm. there's the floor is a little twisted and we've had to fix it, or, you know, there's some paint crumbling off the walls. You know, some of the places are in a state of disrepair to some degree that we have to stabilize, but they're not visitor ready to the owners of the sites, even though they're visitor ready and safe. The owner has to be persuaded that they're actually interesting as they are. It doesn't need to be restored. People would love to go in this space. They'd love to check out a contemporary art project.
And
it
doesn't
space.
Reflect badly on you.
No, right, yeah.
It taps a public interest in authenticity. And the fact that we have so much experience out there. You know, Hollywood can deliver these breathtaking experiences. And the television and everything, the media is there. But we sort of thirst for things that are really dirty, gritty, and authentic. Yeah. And that sort of Indiana Jones, like, I'm going to be the first person in the door and muscle through the cobwebs, that actually has an attraction. We had to, for a site in the first festival, issue hard hats to people because there were some fall hazards. And we thought people would object. And in fact, we had more people who were disappointed when they didn't have to wear hard hats because that was like part of the shtick. And so there were people that just wore them everywhere. So it's an interesting kind of nerve. And we've had to tell sites, please don't clean it up.
Well, you know? That said, we do tell people, you know, on the festival website that, you know, you need to wear good shoes. You have to be prepared for uneven surfaces, climbing, dust. I mean, this is the case.
Yep. Let me get Karima from Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. Karima, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to say thank you to Hidden City. I mean, the festival is great. This is the first year that I've gone. I actually went last Thursday. And my goal was to make it to all nine sites. I didn't make it to all nine. I made it to seven.
You go.
But it was great. It was such an adventure. And I started out at the Germantown Town Hall. And I grew up not too far from there. I don't live too far from there now. And I remember calling my mom, and I was all excited. And I was like, oh, I finally got to go in that building. And she's like, oh, I remember going in there. She's like, and I took you in there when you were little. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's like almost 40 years ago. You know, but I went in, and, you know, it was just something to see, like you're saying, like the calendars and the desks and things like that. You know, so, and then from there I went over to Frankfurt, and I got to go to the Frankfurt Historical Society, and I learned that, I think Frankfurt and Germantown are sister neighborhoods, and I didn't know that, and I didn't know about all the amazing colonial history over there. So it was just great.
That's great.
I just kept, you know, motoring around the city, and I thought Shifte, the synagogue, that was fascinating. Fort Mifflin was great. So I think I have Hawthorne Hall and the Natatorium to get to this week, so I can't wait.
Well, Karima, you've made three men very happy this morning on Radio Times. They're all just grinning and nodding. Thanks for the call. Pete, did you want to add? Germantown Hall is interesting, and she mentioned that.
Yeah, it's another building that's been closed for more than 20 years. It is called Germantown Town Hall, so it's, in a sense, integral to Germantown's identity, particularly its identity separate from the city of Philadelphia. Germantown was its own town for 150 years, and they retained that pride and independence. And to see it, you know, closed up, I think, was really disappointing for a lot of people. And so when we finally opened those big double doors that are in the front, you know, it was just a magical thing. And, you know, even the LNI inspector was taking his iPhone out, and he was taking pictures for himself. Wow. He's like, wow, this is fantastic. The police officers from there's a little police station nearby. They came in and checked it out because they wanted to know. And just seeing it, you know, it's a tough building. You know, it's on the market, $400,000. But, you know, there's a reason why it's still vacant. And it's because it's hard to find a use for it. But just for people to see it, that's amazing.
What does it smell like when you open a door? I mean, just, you know, some of these places.
Do you really want to know?
I do. I have a thing for smells, but I do.
It varies.
Yeah. I mean, I would think musty.
There's the musty basement smell. And we've had some respiratory issues with the team over the years. We call it Hidden City Lung.
Oh, is that right? Just breathing in some of that dust.
No, I mean, there's no. We're very careful with hazardous materials, but it's you know, it's dusty and dirty, and that's part of the magic. But yes, it is kind of a wonderful first experience going into these places.
Karima, thanks. Yeah, go ahead, Lee.
I just wanted to mention the project at that site, which I am so excited about. It's called Germantown City Hall. The artist working on that site is Jacob Wick, who's based out of Oakland, and he's partnered with a group of people based out of Germantown called the Think Tank that has yet to be named. And they've actually turned Germantown Town Hall, which never served as a town hall, into a people's functioning city hall, a town hall by the people, of the people. And they're doing things like having flag workshops. They're having town hall meetings. They have offices and a copy room. And basically groups from around Germantown are going on site, which could be all different kinds of groups, like a photography group, art groups, but also like a babysitting collective, for example, other kinds of informal groups are allowed to use that space and turn it into a functioning city hall. And I'm just so excited by what they've been able to do there.
Well, the think tank that is yet to be named, I hope they hold on to that name forever. That's great. Let me get Greg from Brookhaven to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Marty, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Show as usual.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask your guests if there's anything left of Frankfurt Arsenal. I saw they demolished quite a bit of it last fall, and it's right next to the Disson plant. Yes. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Greg, thanks for the call. I'm going to toss that to Peter.
Frankfurt Arsenal is a site of absolutely critical historical importance. I mean, you know, so many different things with ammunition, and there's innovations that happened there. Very much a counterpart to the Navy Yard. Unfortunately, unlike the Navy Yard, it hasn't been redeveloped sensitively, and they actually tore down half of the arsenal.
Wow.
So all those, it was the more industrial buildings that were torn down. And they were torn down to basically build a shopping mall. But not a big fancy one, just like, you know.
Like a strip mall?
Strip mall, exactly. And you know, so there's plenty left there, but we've lost a ton.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Thaddeus, you actually did a piece for This I Believe, for WHYY's This I Believe, and I have a copy of it here. And one of the things you said was, I spent a childhood trespassing on various mainline estates, pretending that I owned them. This was a bit about your childhood growing up on the mainline, also a bit about your parents. But the fact that, obviously, this interest in old buildings is something that's been with you for a while.
Yeah, it started out of pure, as I said earlier, pure unadulterated sort of curiosity for these places. And I had a very curious friendship in middle school. We were both sort of burgeoning preservationists, even though we didn't know it.
In middle school,
yes, I was a little bit of a freak show in middle school. the property is the Gibson Maybrook, as it's called, the Gibson Estate in Wynwood, that my friend lived next to. And so we spent a lot of time exploring, and we even got into some sort of vigilante preservation, and were frequently escorted off the property by the Lower Marion Police, who didn't know what to do with us because there wasn't really a charge for reglazing windows. They knew how to charge somebody for breaking windows, but we were putting them back. So, but the owner of the property didn't really like us there, and that sort of started a fascination. I think I've always been interested in sort of this kind of very powerful cultural trope of whether it's Indiana Jones or opening up King Tut's tomb or Piranesi's prisons. I mean, this is a very old, very, very fundamental human curiosity. It's the what's in there, what's behind the door I'm not allowed to open.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it has to do with the forbidden. And, you know, Hidden City takes that very primal interest, which is not just mine. It's shared by many, many people, as you know. And leverages that into something much richer and much more sort of future thinking, and that's the intention. Right. So your caller before is the poster child for
indeed.
What we want to see to your question earlier.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. Lee, you want to add something? I want to get back to our callers.
Sure. Yeah, well, I would just quickly add that there's something really nice about being able to do that in Philadelphia, access the be an explorer, to access something that's previously been closed or lesser known. And you don't have to go to other countries. You don't have to go to developing nations. You don't have to fly around the globe. It's right here in our city.
Let me get Jack from Haddonfield to join us. Jack, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
I was just wondering what the impact has been or should be from 4 years ago, you know, on these buildings as a result of them being put into the spotlight.
Yeah, Thaddeus, we touched on this earlier, but a quick response, if that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned earlier in the show a couple examples. Girard College Founders Hall is now being actively reused, parts of it that weren't being used before. It's also making a stronger case for the preservation of that building, which is a very significant building, but very expensive to preserve. It was designed by Thomas U. Walter, who went on to design the dome of the Capitol building in D.C. It was his first major building, commissioned by Stephen Girard, whose name is all over Philadelphia, sure. 19th century merchant and financier. Shiloh Baptist Church at 21st and Christian, which is a sprawling sort of magical mid-19th century church, was largely underknown to the broader community, though an active congregation, and is now home to several arts organizations and has been a venue for a couple festivals, little festivals in that neighborhood since then. And a lot of that grew out of the energy from that first festival. Partners for Sacred Places has done a lot of the work to kind of continue the momentum there. So it's not just us, it's other organizations out there who are really taking the ball and running with it. And that's what we want to see happen. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Distin, and this festival we've launched a website that's still sort of being tested that allows people to go on, sign up as members, and sort of contribute volunteer time, money, materials to the sites. And we're hoping that beyond the festival, this could be a platform for generating community interest and indeed real impact over the long term at these sites.
And we're almost out of time here. Peter, just final word for you. So are you still combing the city looking for sites for the next festival?
Oh, no. I'm behind the desk trying to get the permitting worked out.
Oh, you're all about permits now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, but no, I mean, exploring the city is amazing. You don't have to go to Italy. You can do it right here. It's Philadelphia is the greatest.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our discussion. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Peter Woodall, thank you very much. Hidden City Philadelphia's Outreach Director, Lee Tussman, thank you very much as well. Hidden City's Creative Director, and Thaddeus Squire, the founder of the group.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and we put some pictures of some of these 9 sites on our webpage. And Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, assistance from Emily Bryant, Katie Ricciardi, our intern. And the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.